It's Tuesday, the 26th of November, 2024, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman in Flagstaff, bringing you these headlines from the Wall Street Journal. Special counsel drops Trump cases. Israeli cabinet to vote on Hezbollah ceasefire. Mexico, Canada, China face tariffs. Beginning with our first article by Ryan Barber. Special counsel drops Trump cases. Smith cites policy against prosecution of sitting president ahead of inaugural. Special counsel Jack Smith moved Monday to drop two landmark criminal cases against President-elect Donald Trump, one accusing him of plotting to overturn the 2020 election, and another alleging he unlawfully retained classified documents on the grounds that Justice Department policy prohibits prosecuting a sitting president. That prohibition is categorical and does not turn on the gravity of the crime charged, the strength of the government's proof, or the merits of the prosecution, which the government stands fully behind, Smith's team said in its request to dismiss the election interference case. Trump, in a social media post, said, "These cases, like all of the other cases I've been forced to go through, are empty and lawless, and should never have been brought." Though Smith's actions were expected, they formally marked the end of an unprecedented chapter in U.S. history. Trump was the first former president to be charged with a crime. He's faced four prosecutions in total, with the federal cases joined by charges in New York and Georgia. Those state-level cases remain alive for now, but both face the prospect of dismissal or indefinite delays. All of the prosecutions were slow to materialize. Trump had been out of office for more than 2 years before he was indicted. That meant the cases played out while Trump was campaigning for a return to the White House, with prosecutors fighting tight timeframes, as well as the former president's defense lawyers, who used an array of maneuvers to prevent the cases from advancing quickly. Given that the cases were started late in the Biden administration, and given the likely appeals of any guilty verdicts, we were never going to have the final word on these cases before the election, University of Virginia law professor Shakrishna Prakash said. Trump also used the charges as a centerpiece of his presidential campaign, arguing his opponents were using the justice system to target him. He vowed to fire Smith within 2 seconds of taking office. A Trump-appointed federal judge in Florida already dismissed the classified documents case earlier this year, ruling that Smith was unlawfully appointed. The special counsel's office had appealed that decision, but on Monday dropped its bid to revive that prosecution against Trump. Smith moved to dismiss the election interference case without prejudice, leaving open the theoretical possibility that some future prosecutor could attempt to bring charges anew. Judge Tanya Chutkan granted the request. Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Smith as special counsel in November 2022, just days after Trump announced he would make another bid for the presidency. The move to appoint an independent prosecutor, Garland said, was designed to prevent the appearance of political influence at a Justice Department overseen by Trump's then-opponent, President Biden. Following the election, the special counsel's team began evaluating how to wind down the federal cases. Smith is expected to step down as counsel before Trump's inauguration. The fates of the two state cases could be determined soon. In New York, Trump was convicted of 34 state felonies earlier this year for covering up hush money paid to a porn star. His sentencing, which had previously been scheduled for Tuesday, is now on hold. Trump, a Republican, has asked the presiding judge to toss the conviction. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat who brought the case, said Trump's conviction should stand, but he signaled a willingness to delay additional proceedings until after the president-elect completes his next term of office. Lawyers for Trump and Bragg are expected to file additional arguments early in December, leaving the matter in the hands of the judge. In Georgia, a state-level election interference case against Trump is on shaky ground. It's been on hold for months as a state appeals court weighed a bid to disqualify the Fulton County District Attorney, Fannie Willis, over a revelation that she had a romantic relationship with a lawyer she hired to manage the prosecution. Aside from that drama, the case is imperiled by Trump's election as well as a Supreme Court ruling in July that granted presidents significant immunity for actions taken as a part of their official duties. Smith's election interference case, originally filed in August 2023, was arguably the most ambitious of all the prosecutions. His team offered sweeping allegations that Trump pulled the levers of power to pressure state officials, along with Vice President Mike Pence and the Justice Department, to advance his baseless claims of election fraud and help him remain in power in a chain of events that culminated in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. The Supreme Court's immunity decision appeared to be a significant blow to the special counsel's work, but Smith held his ground with a reworked indictment that left in place the same charges Trump originally faced. The Justice Department's policy against prosecuting a sitting president rests on the notion that doing so would interfere with his ability to fulfill his constitutional role. Smith noted on Monday that the Trump situation was unprecedented because he was a private citizen when he was indicted. But after internal consultations, the department concluded that the policy applied and that the cases had to be dismissed before Trump's inauguration. In the classified documents case, prosecutors charged Trump with deliberately retaining sensitive documents related to U.S. intelligence and defense plans, even after government officials demanded their return. Trump and two aides, Walt Nathle and Carlos de Oliveira, were also accused of seeking to have security footage from Mar-a-Lago, where the documents were being held, deleted so it couldn't be turned over to a grand jury. The Justice Department appeal involving the two aides remains ongoing. Smith is set to prepare a report on his investigation, which the Attorney General could then make public. Corrine Ramey and Mariah Timms contributed to this article, Special Counsel Drops Trump Cases. Our next item, Israeli cabinet to vote on Hezbollah ceasefire. This is by Adam Chamsuddin and Jared Malzin in Beirut and Alexander Ward in Washington. Israel's security cabinet plans to vote Tuesday on a ceasefire agreement with Hezbollah. Israeli and U.S. officials said a deal would end fighting that has destabilized Lebanon and displaced hundreds of thousands of people. An Israeli official said the cabinet is expected to approve the pact, but the parties warned against counting on a deal before it was done. Israel has launched thousands of airstrikes in Lebanon since September and invaded the country on October the 1st in an effort to degrade Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed militant group. The offensive has killed many of the group's leaders and wrought destruction throughout Lebanon, though Hezbollah has maintained its ability to fire missiles into Israel. The deal on the table includes a 60-day implementation period to allow the Israeli military to withdraw and Lebanese armed forces to secure the border area and prevent fighters from Hezbollah from reestablishing a presence there, according to Lebanese officials. An international committee, along with United Nations peacekeepers, would monitor compliance, they said. The ceasefire proposal is finalized. There are no further negotiations on any remaining conditions for the time being, said Lebanon's Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, Elias Bousab, who nevertheless expressed caution. The ceasefire agreement will be effective in the next coming days, but only if the Israeli cabinet approves it, he said. We in Lebanon remain skeptical, as in the past, all the experiences we had with the Israeli government were not promising. Two U.S. officials said the Biden administration expects Israel to approve the deal soon. Still, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby cautioned on Monday that nothing is done until it's all done, and it's not done right now. It's looking good, one of the Israeli officials said. Israel's Prime Minister's office declined to comment Monday. An Israeli Hezbollah ceasefire would mark a diplomatic victory for the Biden administration and bring calm to one front in a regional conflict that brought Israel and its chief foe, Iran, to the brink of war. Israeli officials said their campaign has devastated Hezbollah and its leadership at a cost of the lives of dozens of Israeli soldiers, hundreds of Hezbollah fighters, and thousands of Lebanese civilians. Some of the people familiar with the matter said there could still be sticking points, including prior Israeli demands that its military preserve the ability to strike even after the signing of a deal should Hezbollah pose new threats in Lebanon. In October, the Lebanese government and Hezbollah pushed back on a U.S.-backed proposal that granted Israel permission to continue striking Lebanon for a two-month period. Inside Israel, opposition to a ceasefire is already mounting, with calls for a protest outside the Security Cabinet's meeting Tuesday against the surrender deal in Lebanon. The progress in talks has been accompanied by large exchanges of fire, including a deadly Israeli strike on a residential building in central Beirut on Saturday and a heavy Hezbollah barrage on Israel on Sunday. The war between Israel and Hezbollah has killed more than 3,700 people in Lebanon, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry, most of them since Israel launched a military offensive against the Iranian-backed militant group in September. More than a million people have been forced from their homes, according to the Lebanese government. Hezbollah began firing rockets into Israel shortly after the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attacks on southern Israel that left 1,200 dead and more than 250 taken hostage. Hezbollah rocket and drone attacks, an effort to aid its smaller Palestinian ally, have caused death and destruction, displacing tens of thousands of civilians from northern Israel. Hostilities in Lebanon would cease on the first day of the agreement, Bousab said. A monitoring committee headed by the U.S. along with France, which has also pushed both sides to embrace a ceasefire, will help ensure implementation, Bousab said. They would join an existing monitoring committee that includes the Lebanese government, Israel, and the UN forces, he said. U.S. and French efforts to stop the Lebanon war have stumbled in the past. Israel launched a massive airstrike on Beirut in September that killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah days after the militant group and the Lebanese government agreed to a ceasefire, according to the Lebanese foreign minister. For about a year, Hezbollah has also refused to accept a ceasefire without a stop to the war in Gaza. The group quietly signaled it was willing to de-link the two wars in recent weeks, though it hasn't publicly acknowledged any shift. Attempts to reach a ceasefire in Gaza have yet to bear fruit, with fundamental disagreements over whether Israel's military can maintain a presence and whether a ceasefire should lead to a permanent end to the fighting. Dov Lieber, Anat Pelid, and Naomi Bisserby contributed to this article, Israeli Cabinet to Vote on Hezbollah Ceasefire. Our next article, Mexico, Canada, China Face Tariffs, is by Natalie Andrews and Andrew Restuccia from Washington. President-elect Donald Trump pledged that soon after taking office, he will slap steep tariffs on Mexico and Canada, two of America's closest allies, as well as China, the clearest indication since his election victory that he plans to follow through on the tough campaign rhetoric that helped propel him to the White House. Posting on his Truth Social platform, Trump said that on the first day of his presidency, he will charge Mexico and Canada a 25% tariff on all products coming into the U.S. He added in a separate social media post that he would impose an additional 10% tariff on all products that come into the U.S. from China, though he didn't specify whether that levy would come on his first day in office. Such a tariff would come on top of existing tariffs the U.S. has already imposed on Chinese goods. This tariff will remain in effect until such time as drugs, in particular fentanyl, and all illegal aliens stop this invasion of our country, Trump wrote, referencing his proposed tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Doing so would likely upend the trade agreement that Trump negotiated with the two neighboring countries in his first term, known as USMCA. U.S. goods and services traded utilizing that trade agreement totaled an estimated $1.8 trillion in 2022, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which oversees U.S. trade agreements. Various laws empower the president to impose tariffs without authorization from Congress, but most require an economic, commercial, or national security justification. It wasn't immediately clear what legal authority Trump plans to invoke. Economists have warned that Trump's plan to impose sweeping tariffs could lead to higher prices on goods for consumers. Trump faulted the two border countries and China for, in his view, not doing enough to stem the flow of drugs or migrants into the U.S. He said Beijing hasn't made good on its promise to prevent fentanyl from coming into the country. Until such time as they stop, we will be charging China an additional 10% tariff above any additional tariffs on all of their many products coming into the United States of America, the president-elect wrote, referring to China. No one will win. Liu Pengyu, a spokesman in the Chinese embassy in Washington, said China believes that China-U.S. economic and trade cooperation is mutually beneficial in nature. No one will win a trade war or a tariff war. Canada's government said that Ottawa buys more from the U.S. than China, Japan, France, and the U.K. combined and provides about 60% of all the oil the U.S. imports from foreign countries. Representatives at the Embassy for Mexico didn't respond to a request for comment. One pro-tariff group applauded the announcement. It shows that Trump is absolutely serious about the agenda that he's been campaigning on, said Nick Icovelia, a spokesman for Coalition for a Prosperous America, which represents domestic manufacturers, farmers, and workers. Democrat Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii posted on social media, Trump tariffs are going to raise the price of lots of stuff regular people buy. Republicans are going to raise the price of your Walmart or Costco trip and use the extra money you pay for tax cuts for multinational corporations. Mexico, China, and Canada are the nation's top three suppliers of imported goods, accounting for about 42% of imports to the U.S. this year through September, according to census data. Canada and Mexico send about 80% of their exports to the U.S., and an across-the-board tariff would hurt their economies. Trade was at the center of Trump's successful presidential bid. In campaign speeches, he said he would put in place an across-the-board tariff of up to 20% on U.S. imports. Billionaire Elon Musk, a close Trump ally, posted on X that the proposed tariffs will be highly effective in stopping illegal migration and drug trafficking. A caravan of about 1,600 migrants, most of them from Venezuela and Central America, left the southern city of Tapachula near Mexico's border with Guatemala on Wednesday. U.S.-bound migrants said they decided to march north and reach the border before Trump takes office in January. Trump's tariff threat comes as human smugglers across the region are urging migrants on social media to rush to the border before the inauguration. So far, six caravans with thousands of migrants have departed from southern Mexico since President Claudia Sheinbaum took office last month. But over the past 5 years, Mexican authorities have disbanded all caravans before they reach central Mexico. Peso weakens. Mexico's peso weakened following Trump's comments, trading at 20.69 to the dollar compared with 20.30 earlier Monday. Trump had made a similar threat when in office in 2019, saying he would impose tariffs of up to 25% on all imported goods from Mexico unless America's southern neighbor took steps to curb the flow of migrants to the U.S. border. Mexico deployed thousands of National Guard members to contain the migration wave, and the tariff threat was dropped. Canada, the world's fourth largest oil producer, sends most of its oil to the U.S. It also has an auto industry that's tightly integrated with its American neighbor. Economists at the Business Development Bank of Canada said the Canadian economy would suffer steep drops in output and employment if Trump imposed tariffs on Canadian imports. Trump has said that he wants to renegotiate the USMCA under provisions of the trade deal allowing for a review of the agreement in 2026. Canada has said it is deploying a team of Canadian government ministers and provincial leaders to court lawmakers in U.S. states and Washington as part of a lobbying effort to protect its $900 billion trade relationship with the U.S. Anthony DiBarros, Santiago Perez, Greg Ip, Hannah Miao, Brian Spiegel, Vipal Monga, and John Camp contributed to this article, Mexico, Canada, China Face Tariffs. We turn now to an article by Santiago Perez and Rafael Huang. BYD plant across border makes waves. Chinese electric vehicle maker BYD is completing plans for a factory in Mexico, a push that will test Donald Trump's trade policies and the Mexican government's appetite for conflict with the president-elect. BYD officials said the company is aiming to reach a deal with Mexico's state officials to break ground on a factory near one of the automotive hubs in central or northern Mexico. The plans put Mexico in a dilemma, made worse by Trump's threat Monday to impose a 25% tariff on Mexican goods. The country is a major car manufacturing center and generally welcomes foreign investment for the jobs it brings. BYD, which rivals Tesla as the biggest electric vehicle maker in the world, would normally be a prize catch. But Mexican officials fear a BYD plant would send the wrong message to Trump and the trade hawks around him by suggesting that Mexico wants to be a backdoor for Chinese companies to sell to U.S. consumers. Mexico has said it wants no such thing, and it needs to persuade the U.S. and Canada of that when talks begin next year on extending the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement on free trade reached during the first Trump administration. At this time, investments from China have to be analyzed with extreme caution, said Eduardo Solis, a consultant who previously led Mexico's Automotive Industry Association. Mexico has to present itself with a business card that says, Reliable Partner of North America. Trump, a Republican, earlier threatened to impose a 200% tariff on Chinese companies' cars if they're manufactured in Mexico. Mexico's concern over Chinese investment is another example of how Trump's election is forcing governments and companies to rethink their strategies. Canadian officials are trying to isolate Mexico to align themselves more closely with Trump. BYD has long dreamed of bringing its vehicles to the U.S. as Asian carmakers such as Toyota and Hyundai did before it. But each possible avenue has run into barriers. Exporting from China is nearly impossible after the Biden administration imposed roughly 100% tariffs on Chinese-made EVs this year. Trying to build a car plant in the U.S. like those of Japanese and South Korean automakers would undoubtedly meet stiff resistance given anti-China sentiment in the U.S. BYD has had an electric bus factory in Lancaster, California for a decade, and it is North America's largest electric bus manufacturer with annual production capacity of about 1,500 vehicles. But that area is less politically sensitive than cars sold to consumers. BYD's most recent thinking, people at the company said, is to build a plant in Mexico initially to serve Mexican and other Latin American car buyers while awaiting a shift in the political winds that would allow exports to the U.S. Now, even this strategy is uncertain. Building a plant in Mexico would require buy-in from both the state in which it is located as well as the federal government, and that is where problems have emerged. Several Mexican states have dialed back the incentives they're offering to BYD to attract the plant, such as local tax benefits and cheaper water, people familiar with the matter said. The federal government isn't happy with BYD's timing and doesn't want to provoke Trump, a Mexican official said. Federal consent would be essential for any BYD project in Mexico because the company would need environment and import permits. The USMCA, signed by Mexico, the U.S., and Canada in 2018, propelled Mexico to become the world's fourth largest exporter of light vehicles, shipping nearly 2.6 million vehicles to the U.S. last year. While a pact tightened regional content rules, meaning Mexican factories couldn't merely assemble cars made from Asian parts, carmakers adopted the use of parts from Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. Mexico's increased share of the U.S. import market means greater scrutiny, and the main point of contention in the USMCA talks will be how to shield the North American trade bloc from China's influence, J.P. Morgan said in a note to investors. Mexico has said the U.S. and Canadian concern about a Mexican backdoor is misplaced and lacks evidence. Mexican officials also point out that far more Chinese investment goes to the U.S. and Canada than to Mexico. Any measures to block China should be equitable among the three USMCA members, since U.S. carmakers operating in Mexico are also heavy importers of parts and vehicles from China, Mexican officials said. BYD has become the top Chinese EV maker, and it's started expanding around the globe. It has a car factory in Thailand and is building its first Latin American plant in Brazil. Ryan Felton contributed to this article, BYD Plant Across Border Makes Waves. Well, let's turn to the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal for this article, COP29, Climate Groundhog Day. The United Nations COP29 Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, ended this weekend with a promise by wealthy countries to spend $300 billion a year by 2035 to help poorer ones adopt. Was this the ransom for letting high-flying emissaries escape on their private jets? Like the movie Groundhog Day, each UN's annual climate confab is a repeat of the last. Poor countries lambast wealthier nations for their CO2 emissions, wealthy countries self-flagellate and promise to atone by financing climate projects in developing countries. That sums up the blowout in Baku. The U.S. and Europe are hailing the $300 billion deal for climate transfer payments, but like previous commitments, this one isn't legally binding, and almost any international assistance counts towards the goal. As India's emissary noted, it's an optical illusion. In 2009, wealthy countries pledged to spend $100 billion a year as penance for their climate sins. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development took a victory lap in 2022 when wealthy countries supposedly hit that goal, though general development projects backed by multilateral financing agencies accounted for much of the spending. Poorer countries led by India tried to shame their wealthier counterparts by offering up to $1.3 trillion in grants. But rich countries rightly balked at asking their taxpayers to finance climate largesse in low-income countries, especially when they are spending hefty sums trying to meet their own pointless emissions goals. The West's self-defeating climate policies have failed to reduce global emissions and may increase them by driving more manufacturing to China, India, and other countries that rely heavily on coal. Global emissions are set to hit a new peak this year, though U.S. CO2 emissions are expected to decline 0.6% and Europe's by 3.8%. U.S. emissions are declining as cheap and abundant natural gas replaces coal in power production. America's coal emissions are the lowest in more than 120 years. Increasing renewable production has reduced Europe's emissions, but also raised its energy prices and driven more manufacturing to China. The reality is that U.S. shale fracking has done more to reduce emissions than the West's climate mandates and subsidies. This may be why Biden climate envoy John Podesta said he expects U.S. emissions to continue to decline under Donald Trump. By accelerating U.S. liquefied natural gas export projects, Mr. Trump could also reduce global emissions. But don't expect this to stop the same climate movie from replaying next year. That's an opinion piece from the Wall Street Journal, COP29, Climate Groundhog Day. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, reminding you that you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, such as the Wall Street Journal, streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, on your Amazon Dot or Echo device, or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for the iPad or iPhone, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. Moving on to business and finance, we have these headlines. Stores adapt to an online world. Walmart diversity programs ended. And Macy's employee hid millions in expenses. Our first article by Kate King, Stores Adapt to an Online World. TJ Maxx, PetSmart, and other retailers grow even as e-commerce hits records. Online shopping is at a record high. For a change, shopping center owners aren't threatened. Americans bought $300 billion in retail goods online last quarter, with e-commerce accounting for 16.2% of all retail sales, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. That proportion is nearly back to peak levels in 2020, when many stores were closed and cash-flush Americans ordered Peloton bikes and sourdough starters from their couches. Still, after years of worrying that e-commerce would decimate bricks-and-mortar stores, retail landlords now say the sector is stronger and more insulated from online competitors than even a few years ago. A sharp slowdown in retail construction is driving vacancies to near-record lows. While Americans stayed home during the height of the pandemic, they flocked back to stores and restaurants as infection concerns faded. E-commerce was thought of as this as existential threat, said Jahan Mosley, chief executive of the real estate investment firm Bridge 33 Capital, which has spent $574 million acquiring 13 shopping centers this year. In the past few years, we've seen this resilience of bricks and mortar retail. Retailers are figuring out how to adapt to e-commerce's continued growth. Most successful offer their customers experiences they can't find online, such as indoor rock climbing at Dick's House of Sport and eyebrow waxing at Sephora, and make it easy for customers to buy from them in both in-person and online. Less than 2% of TJX's total sales occurred online in 2023 and through the first 6 months of this year, according to a spokesman. The company, which owns several brands, including TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and Home Goods, attracts shoppers from across the income spectrum by creating a treasure hunt experience. It sources merchandise in limited quantities from 21,000 vendors in more than 100 countries. The strategy prompts hardcore shoppers to time their visits with the arrival of new shipments in the hopes of snagging heavily discounted designer handbags and clothing. The potential for an amazing deal attracts even millionaires who could otherwise afford to pay market rate for luxury items. TJX's middle and lower income customers shop there because it is affordable and a form of entertainment, said Molishi, who has 28 TJX tenants in his portfolio. There's a good portion of this country that is really struggling, he said, going to the movie theater, going on a vacation, staying at a hotel. These things are out of reach for them. Going to TJ Maxx, where you can go on a treasure hunt. Everyone loves finding value. Discount chains are among the fastest expanding retailers in the U.S., and TJX has opened 342 net new stores since 2019. Outside of the discount sector, most retailers have learned from trial and error that integrating the online and in-person shopping experiences is crucial to survival. Retailers such as home furnishings and department stores that closed physical locations in favor of their e-commerce operations found customers in those markets forgot about them. Brands such as eyewear maker Warby Parker, that started online to avoid real estate expenses, discovered they needed physical stores to acquire new customers. And most retailers have accepted that customers want to buy items online, have them delivered quickly, and return what they don't want in store. After years of investing heavily in warehouses, many retail chains have turned to their own fleet of stores as a more cost-effective way of delivering to customers' homes. PetSmart, which has nearly 1,700 locations across the U.S. and Canada, now ships more than 90% of online orders to customers' homes from its stores. The company has formed partnerships with third-party delivery services such as DoorDash and Uber Eats to expand its same-day delivery capabilities and acquire new customers. We really focused our digital offerings on being able to have many different ways that customers can shop, said Cherise Ordlock, Senior Vice President of Digital for PetSmart. Long known as a takeout delivery service, DoorDash now has more than 115,000 non-restaurant retailers on its platform, including beauty retailer Ulta, home improvement chain Lowe's, and electronics retailer Best Buy's. Really good retailers are rethinking the purpose of the store, said Fouad Hanan, vice president at DoorDash. Costco member Jan Folk said she likes to browse the big box retailer's monthly coupon mailers as well as a smartphone app for deals before making her purchase in person. I like to not have to buy something sight unseen online, said Falk, 61 years old, who works in banking and lives in a suburb of Cleveland. I can check it out first in the warehouse. $300 billion, the amount of money U.S. shoppers spent on retail goods online last quarter. And that stores adopt to an online world. Next, we have Walmart diversity programs ended. This is by Sarah Nassauer. Walmart is ending some of its diversity programs and the latest big company to shift gears under pressure from a conservative activist. The retailer will wind down the Center for Racial Equity, a nonprofit Walmart funded with $100 million in 2020 for 5 years, and programs that provide assistance to suppliers that are 51% owned by women, minorities, veterans, or members of the LGBTQ community. Walmart will also stop allowing third-party sellers to offer some LGBTQ-themed items on Walmart.com, including items marketed to transgender children like chest binders and some books, the spokeswoman said. Walmart has more than 2 million global employees and typically tries to stay neutral on hot-button social issues to appeal to a spectrum of shoppers and workers. On Monday, Walmart also said it would continue to phase out the term diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, in company documents, as well as stop sharing data on its LGBTQ corporate policies with the Human Rights Campaign, an organization that has become a target of conservative activists. Anti-DEI provocateur Robbie Starbuck posted a video Monday on X, taking credit for Walmart ending some of its diversity efforts. Starbuck has successfully nudged other companies, including retailer Tractor Supply and manufacturers Ford and Deere, to back away from diversity efforts and other topics. Starbuck said in an interview that he'd spoken with Walmart recently to let them know he planned to criticize some of its diversity programs and some of the LGBTQ-themed items marketed on its website. No retail company wants a story about them from us ahead of Black Friday, he said. Some of the changes touted by Starbuck were already in motion as part of a broader turn away from DEI in corporate America, the Walmart spokeswoman said. Some diversity-themed supplier programs were being phased out due to legal challenges of similar practices, she said. The company will fulfill its existing 5-year commitment to fund the Center for Racial Equity through 2025. We're willing to change alongside our associates and customers who represent all of America. We've been on a journey and know we aren't perfect, Walmart said in a statement. Walmart Chief Executive Doug McMillon has spoken publicly about racial equity, especially in the wake of George Floyd's killing, and about gun violence after a 2019 mass shooting at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. In 2020, McMillon announced that Walmart would fund the Center for Racial Equality, slavery, lynching, the concept of separate but equal, and other realities from our past have morphed into a set of systems today that are all too often unjust, McMillon said at the time in a statement. Donald Trump's election victory is added to a growing activist movement that put firms in the crosshairs of heated cultural and political debates. Bud Light lost its spot as a top-selling beer in the U.S. last year after controversy over a social media promotion with a transgender influencer. It has since recovered some of those losses. Target sales fell in the summer of 2023 after criticism of its Gay Pride Month merchandise displays. Boeing recently dismantled its DEI department and reassigned staffers to another team within the company's human resources department. Boeing CEO Kelly Ortberg said at an employee meeting last week, Boeing is a major Pentagon contractor, and DEI programs are likely to come under additional fire in the next Trump administration, Ortberg told staff. We are going to go through a little bit of a tumultuous period here in terms of things that are called DEI, he said. Boeing will focus on making sure that everybody's got a chance. Nobody's being discriminated against. Sharon Turlip contributed to this article, Walmart Diversity Programs Ended. Our next item, Macy's Employee Hid Millions in Expenses, is by Ben Glickman and Suzanne Kapner. Macy's delayed its quarterly results after the company discovered that an employee had hidden up to $154 million in delivery expenses over several years, prompting an investigation. The retailer said Monday that a single employee responsible for small package delivery expense accounting had intentionally made erroneous bookkeeping entries since late 2021. The individual didn't pocket the amounts in question, and the company declined to say how it uncovered the erroneous entries or how it went undetected by the company's auditor, KPMG. Macy's said it would provide details on its investigation when it reports quarterly results on December 11th. While Macy cannot control the actions of every employee, it's worrying that these are intentional accounting errors that go back to 2021, said Neil Saunders, managing director of research firm Global Data. It also raises the question as to the competence of the company's auditors. A KPMG spokesman declined to comment. The accounting firm has served as Macy's auditor since 1988. The disclosure came the day before Macy's had been scheduled to report its third quarter results, though the company released preliminary sales figures on Monday that were in line with forecasts. Shares of Macy's closed down 2.2% Monday. The department store chain said its internal investigation found that the employee had hidden $132 million to $154 million cumulatively from the fourth quarter of 2021 through the most recent period. The company said it had recognized about $4.36 billion in delivery expenses over the same period. Macy's said there was no evidence the accounting errors had affected its cash management or payments to vendors. The company hasn't identified involvement by any other employees, and the person who was responsible for the errors is no longer employed by the company. Macy's is the latest company to report issues in financial statements amid a deepening shortage of qualified accountants in the last several years. Fewer students have pursued accounting degrees, leading to more openings that remain unfilled for longer, and experts say the problem might worsen as more accountants retire. The delayed results come as Macy's looks to turn around slumping sales. Chief Executive Tony Spring has taken aim at revamping the company's business by closing underperforming locations and improving customer experience. These efforts have clashed with continued wariness from shoppers who the company says have been more value-conscious and have spent more time browsing aisles. The company said that based on preliminary results, sales fell 2.4% to $4.74 billion in the quarter ended November the 2nd. Sales exceeded the $4.72 billion expected by analysts polled by FactSet. Comparable sales were down 2.4% in company-owned stores. The retailer said strength in fragrances, dresses, and active apparel was offset by weaker sales in digital channels and in cold weather categories. Macy's said that its comparable sales in November were on pace to exceed results in the third quarter. Mark Maurer contributed to this article, Macy's Employee Hid Millions in Expenses. Our next item is by Vicky Gui Hang and Alexander Osipovich. MicroStrategy flies high with Bitcoin as its fuel. Bitcoin prices have surged more than 30% since Election Day. MicroStrategy has climbed even faster. The software company turned itself into a Bitcoin buying machine in 2020 and now holds some $36 billion worth of tokens. For many individual investors, the stock is a more popular Bitcoin play than the cryptocurrency itself, and they're willing to pay up for it. With a $91 billion market value, MicroStrategy is trading at more than twice the value of its underlying Bitcoin. The shares have soared more than sixfold this year and 77% since November the 5th, with traders betting that the digital assets industry will flourish under President-elect Donald Trump. Bitcoin prices are hovering below $94,000 after trading near $100,000 last week. MicroStrategy found a way to outperform Bitcoin, Michael Saylor, the company's founder and executive chairman, said. The way that we outperform Bitcoin, in essence, is we just lever up Bitcoin. Saylor said he's just getting started. He unveiled an audacious plan just days before the election to hire investment banks to raise $42 billion in capital over 3 years through stock and bond offerings to buy more tokens. His company had $4.3 billion in convertible debt outstanding as of October the 29th. MicroStrategy's mix of Bitcoin maximalization and Wall Street-style financial engineering has paid off for its investors, but skeptics question whether it is sustainable. Saylor's heavy use of leverage or borrowed money to buy Bitcoin backfired during the 2022 crypto market meltdown, when the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX dragged Bitcoin prices below $16,000. Quarter after quarter, MicroStrategy incurred mounting losses tied to Bitcoin, and Saylor stepped down as CEO, a position he'd held since 1989. This stock has become detached from reality, said Andrew Left, a prominent short seller and founder of Citron Research. Left describes himself as bullish on Bitcoin itself and praised MicroStrategy in 2020 when it first began amassing Bitcoin. But in a post Thursday on X, Left said he had taken out a bet against MicroStrategy, which caused its stock to tumble. Some analysts warn MicroStrategy's run-up is part of investor euphoria for speculative assets and will inevitably collapse. David Trainer, founder of research firm New Construct, said MicroStrategy is a bad business by conventional metrics. For instance, it has posted a net loss for the past three quarters. It's symptomatic of a market that's become obsessed with believing in get-rich-quick schemes, Trainer said. If you like Bitcoin, go buy Bitcoin, but don't invest in a company that's losing money and also buying Bitcoin, because then you're sort of doubled your risk. Some traders say a part of the stock's appeal is volatility, which can help amplify gains over a short period. Garriott Sheary, a barber in Florence, Alabama, bought one share of MicroStrategy at $436.53 in his retirement account last Tuesday afternoon and sold it at $472.40 Wednesday morning, notching a quick profit. Restricted from purchasing Bitcoin in his Roth IRA account, the 39-year-old crypto enthusiast has had to settle for Bitcoin proxies like MicroStrategy stock and Bitcoin exchange-traded funds. He holds some shares of the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF. I don't think Bitcoin went up 8% in the last 24 hours, but MicroStrategy did, said Sheary, who had been investing in cryptocurrency since the pandemic. Saylor said he came up with the Bitcoin strategy in 2020 when COVID-19 forced lockdowns and the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to zero. MicroStrategy was competing with tech giants such as Microsoft and falling behind. The company was under pressure to return cash to shareholders through stock buybacks and dividends. It was either a fast death or a slow death, or take a risk, do something out of the box, he said. Saylor's often boasted about MicroStrategy's volatility. When you embrace volatility, then you're outperforming the S&P, he said during last month's earnings call. MicroStrategy's volatility has helped it find ready buyers for its repeated issuances of convertible bonds, debt that can eventually be converted into shares if the stock price rises to a specified level. Such bonds are often purchased by hedge funds that protect themselves against a collapse in the stock's price by going short or placing a bet that the stock will fall. Such funds generally don't focus on whether the company is a good long-term investment and instead seek to profit from the volatility of its stock. MicroStrategy is an attractive trade for convertible bond arbitragers, said Vadim Ilosevic, a veteran hedge fund trader in New York. We can definitely agree that the volatility will be there, he said. Some investors are turning to ETFs that seek to amplify the return of MicroStrategy shares using borrowed money or derivative contracts. One such fund, Defiance Daily Target 2X Long MSTR ETF, aims to double the daily return of the stock and has attracted $1.8 billion in assets since it launched in August. Other funds allow traders to make inverse bets. Chase Fury, a 25-year-old trader in Newport Beach, California, said he started buying Bitcoin-related stocks, including Coinbase Global, MicroStrategy, and BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF in October. Hoping to turbocharge the gains, he moved all of his investments worth about $112,000 into the Defiance ETF instead, and has grown his portfolio to about $400,000. The Harvard graduate, who studied economics in college, persuaded his parents to let him manage $700,000 of their retirement assets. He said he came up with a less dangerous and smarter plan for them, investing 27% of their portfolio in the Defiance ETF and the rest in MicroStrategy shares. The money has more than doubled to $1.8 million, he said. I think Bitcoin could hit $400,000, and I think MicroStrategy could possibly be 10x or 10 times from where it is now by the end of the year, so that's kind of my game plan with that, he said. Even some Bitcoin bulls have expressed unease about the risks investors face by betting on MicroStrategy. Mike Novogratz, the billionaire CEO of crypto trading firm Galaxy Digital, warned in an interview on CNBC last Thursday that Bitcoin could fall 20% after peaking at $100,000, in part because of leveraged bets on MicroStrategy available through some exchange-traded funds. The crypto community is levered to the gills right now, so there will be a correction, Novogratz said. That's MicroStrategy flies high with Bitcoin as its fuel. We have time for one more article, this one from Heard on the Street. Food sector sell-off looks overdone. The industry can handle potential increase in regulation in Trump administration. More inflation pressures, not so much. This article is by Aaron Back. America's packaged food industry has been one of the worst performers in the stock market since the election. The prospect that a Health and Human Services Department led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. could crack down on things like sugar and artificial additives appears to be driving much of the decline. While its potential impact on the sector shouldn't be exaggerated, it comes on top of a host of other factors that have kept the group out of investor favor for some time. The consumer staples sector within the S&P 500 is up less than 3% since November the 4th, compared with a 4.5% rise for the overall index. But this sector is large and diverse, including major retailers like Walmart and Costco, which are both up since the election. Makers of household goods like Procter & Gamble and Clorox have also risen. Concern appears to be focused on food. Kraft Heinz, General Mills, and Campbell Soup have fallen by an average of nearly 7%. Coca-Cola and PepsiCo are down around 1.8% and 2.6% respectively. For most of these names, declines accelerated after Kennedy was unveiled as the HHS nominee. What could he do as HHS secretary? The Food and Drug Administration could become less tolerant of the use of artificial flavors, colors, and sweeteners, banning some or requiring more prominent labeling on packages. But the industry has been through many cycles like this before and always found a way to adapt, such as the FDA ban on artificial trans fats that began in 2015. The impact on corporate bottom lines from new restrictions wouldn't be positive, but it would certainly be manageable. In a September opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, Kennedy proposed other steps that would be more worrisome to the industry. For instance, he advocated restricting the use of supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits, known as food stamps, to buy soda or processed foods. That could indeed be significant. A reduction in food stamps benefits in 2023 had a major impact on food company sales. But as J.P. Morgan analyst Ken Goldman points out in a note, food stamps are administered by the Agriculture Department, not HHS. What's more, the definition of what constitutes processed foods is highly debatable. A loose definition could hit virtually everything packaged food companies sell, from pasta sauce to plain Cheerios. Restricting food stamp recipients to fresh ingredients and forcing them to cook every meal from scratch would hardly be practical. In his opinion piece, Kennedy proposed overhauling farm subsidies that make corn, soybeans, and wheat artificially cheap, so those crops end up in many processed forms. Good luck with that. Agricultural subsidies for these staple crops have such strong political backing that cutting them would make the food stamp measure look simple. And this falls even further outside of HHS, likely requiring legislation. As Goldman points out, the Kennedy freakout over packaged food stocks comes on top of years of accumulated worries, such as a decades-long shift away from carbohydrates in diets, increasing competition from small brands and private labels, the rise of anti-obesity drugs, and reduced pricing power as consumers get fed up with food inflation. The latter could be a particular worry if there's a resurgence of inflation pressures under the Trump administration, for example, from a crackdown on immigrant farm labor. These companies, already the targets of popular anger over price increases, could find themselves with little room to pass on costs. In short, there are many reasons not to love food stocks at the moment. Cooler heads could soon prevail on the risks that Kennedy actually poses to the sector. That doesn't mean the industry's prospects are bright. That's food sector sell-off looks overdone. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, the 26th of November, and remind you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store for your phone or tablet, or you can listen to the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream on your Amazon Echo or Dot.